from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, beheading again, NATO on ISIS, Russia, Ukraine, fast food workers walk out, Joan Rivers has died. President Obama was cool and determined after the beheading of a second American journalist by the Islamic State. Joe Biden was hot.
We will follow them to the gates of hell until they are brought to justice. Because hell is where they will reside.
As NATO met in Wales, Ukraine's ambassador to the UN said Russian talk of peace could not be trusted.
The message is that they are ready for the peaceful settlement are words. We need deeds.
And comedian icon Joan Rivers has died at 81. She talked with us just last month and at more length in 2009.
I always was an outsider. It's always about, I always say, if I was sitting next to a friend, what would we be saying to each other? And that's truly what my comedy has always been.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What's your top story this week? ISIS, Russia, fast food pay, naked hacking? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us now from Washington is David Ignatius, foreign affairs columnist and associate editor at The Washington Post. David, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Tom.
Molly Ball is with us, national political correspondent at The Atlantic. Molly, great to have you as well.
Great to be here, Tom.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Molly.
David, let's go straight to the latest news of a ceasefire agreement. There's been a lot of talk all week long. None of it has really produced a breakthrough. Do you see one now, David?
Well, we still don't know the details of this ceasefire agreement. It's supposed to take place today. We'll have to watch. From early reports, it seems as if it will, in effect, ratify the gains Russia has made by its proxy invasion of eastern Ukraine and leave the situation in Ukraine very unsettled so that Russia can step up the pressure if it feels its proxy forces, the separatists in the east, are not getting sufficient leverage. It seems from what we've read from President Poroshenko, the Ukrainian president, as if he's really seeking peace because the level of bloodshed and the reversals for his own forces in the last 2 weeks have been so severe that, as he said in a statement within the last day or so, peace is essential in a crisis like this. But you can't help but think that this is going to ratify Russian gains in a way that is going to have continuing problems and unsettlement for that part of Europe.
Molly, there's been a lot of tough talk this week out of NATO. First from President Obama before he even got to the meeting in Wales, out of Estonia, and then in Wales, Cardiff. Do we see this as a fait accompli? Perhaps Russia with a finger, more than a finger, inside Ukraine and not going away despite all the big talk from NATO.
Well, you know, I heard President Poroshenko from Ukraine on the BBC this morning sort of trying to put a good face on things. And as David said, he seems to be accepting and trying to get his people to accept that there is going to have to be a resolution that does grant some territory to Russia. And he also issued a warning saying, you know, if Russia says they can take Kiev, they can also take Vilnius, they can take Budapest, they can take Warsaw. And so, you know, he clearly feels trying to sound the alarm for the West, saying that not enough was done to defend Ukraine, and that is the feeling out of NATO as well, that they're talking about, you know, more sanctions, ways to get tough, and President Obama ratcheting up the rhetoric this week. But the reality is that most people now are seeing that Russia is going to get some of what they set out to get.
I'm not sure where we are in this story, Jack. This was sound from just Tuesday. This was Democratic Senator Bob Menendez, New Jersey, talking with NPR Steve Inskeep, saying this was only Tuesday, Jack, that the U.S. needs to supply Ukraine with defensive weapons against Russia.
Thousands of Russian troops have crossed into Ukraine. They've come in with columns of tanks and armored vehicles and surface-to-surface missiles. This is no longer the premise that, separatists are fighting. And this is a continuation of the violation of international order that Russia has created.
There is certainly a change in the international order. Jack, that was just Tuesday, and talk there of sending American weapons to Ukraine. Now, David Ignatius and others are saying maybe Ukraine is ready to settle with some loss rather than a bigger danger of further risk.
And understandably, too, you know, 3 weeks ago when Ukraine was making progress, indeed pretty much cutting off the rebels from their Russian supply, Angela Merkel warned them. She said, well, you know, you are making progress, but finally you've got to negotiate. And she didn't quite spell it out, but negotiate on Russia's terms. I mean, if anything was clear out of this NATO meeting, it is that NATO is not coming to the rescue of Ukraine. And, you know, the Ukrainians naturally have you know, magnified the threat that they're facing. Their foreign minister said recent Russian actions demonstrate that Moscow is bluntly drawing Ukraine and the entire world into a full-scale war. No, it's not. It's exerting its power on its border, and there is nothing militarily NATO can do. As for the arms, that was before the NATO summit. I'm reading, at least in the Financial Times, that the European allies would be very cool to any idea of arming Ukraine.
So, David, how do you see the balance of power here now? I mean, it's easy to say Russia asserting power on its border, but that assertion of power was at the heart of the Cold War that went on for decades, Eastern Europe under the Iron Curtain. Here's Ukraine, maybe sliding pieces of it back into Russia's orbit. But Vladimir Putin has expressed, the idea that the loss of the Soviet Union itself was a catastrophe, that, a desire to see the U.S. role in NATO and the West diminished. Are we still in this? Is this still dynamic, David? Does Putin go further?
Well, we don't know, and I think that's the most worrisome question: is what's next? I think just looking at the events of the last few weeks, we'd have to say that Putin has won tactical gains, but at considerable cost. He now has a government in Kiev that is strongly suspicious of, I even want to say, anti Moscow. He has a Europe that is united to a surprising extent, given where it was 6 months ago, in sanctions against Putin in Russia. The French decision not to send the warship they were building for the Russians is an example of that. From the beginning of this, I've had the feeling that while Putin is very tough on the ground in his tactics, he's playing a weak hand and doesn't have a clear strategic vision of where he wants to go. I mean, Russia really is a power in decline. It's flexing its muscles, but the notion that it's going to go back to being a world superpower, given that it has declining population, declining GDP, you look at every demographic measure and this is a country in trouble. So I think we should be careful about overdoing the Putin victory this week, although it is that.
Though it was a part of what has had NATO very much on pins and needles. I mean, you heard Prime Minister David Cameron of Britain talking to his NATO colleagues this week in Wales about an arc of instability and a big one.
We face new and evolving dangers. To the east, Russia is ripping up the rule book with its annexation of Crimea and its troops on sovereign soil in Ukraine. To the south, an arc of instability bends from North Africa to the Middle East.
What's the response likely to be in Washington, Molly, to all of this? I mean, you've got lots of criticism of the president on his pace of response to the Islamic State. You've got Russia maybe moving on into Ukraine. We heard Menendez saying, let's get weapons out there. Okay, maybe that won't happen. And yet this has political ramifications at home.
Absolutely. I think, you know, Congress comes back next week, and we've had several members of Congress in both parties, a lot of Democrats, saying that they want Congress to have a say in the decision of whether to intervene against ISIS. A lot of members of Congress pushing President Obama to take a harder line, again, a sort of bipartisan consensus that he has been too hesitant to sort of speak strongly on this, although there's no consensus on what else he could be doing in terms of concrete actions. And that's always the pushback you get from the White House is sort of, well, what would you do? Sure, tough talk is fine, but what does that actually accomplish? And the rebuttal to that, of course, is that a lot of diplomacy is about what you say. It is about your tone and the tone that you take. And so I think that as Congress comes back next week, we are going to hear a lot of calls for some kind of weighing in on this. Whether that will actually turn into action, you know, it's Congress, so probably not.
Jack, what do you see here? The U.S. with new wisdom, careful calculation, or back on its heels, looking weak, inviting offense?
Well, you know, someone told Elizabeth Drew of the New York Review of Books, a person who's worked with the president on the Middle East, said avoiding another Iraq is his guiding principle. It seems to me that's also the guiding principle of the American people. We don't want this. You know, Robert Gates said, if anyone came to a president and said, intervene in the Middle East, they would say, you're insane. So whatever he does is against the background of what the public wants and what he wants. And yes, it makes him look uncertain, but it is a situation before which you can't be other than uncertain, it seems to me, and represent the reality.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. The Islamic State, NATO, fast food workers walk out. Joan Rivers is gone. Molly Ball is with us, national political writer for The Atlantic. David Ignatius is here, foreign affairs columnist, associate editor at The Washington Post. His latest book, a page-turner novel out this summer, The Director. David, can we turn to the Islamic State and the strategy there? There's this news today of this new coalition being put together on the sidelines of the NATO meeting with intent to destroy ISIS, is the headline. Here was the president in Estonia on Wednesday, degrade and destroy was his language then.
Our objective is clear, and that is to degrade and destroy ISIL so it's no longer a threat, not just to Iraq, but also the region and to the United States.
David Ignatius, Jack Beatty says the American people do not want another Iraq. What does it mean to form a new coalition? We'll be talking about coalition partners here that's setting out to destroy ISIS. Is that not the framework for potentially another Iraq?
Well, it's a framework for a different kind of engagement in Iraq. When a president says that we will degrade and destroy a terrorist group like this, that should be taken seriously. If the president isn't prepared to follow through on that kind of language, there's a real problem. As I look at the strategy, listen to administration officials explain it, it seems basically sensible to me. The premise is that the U.S. needs to work through partners and allies in the region, starting with a more inclusive Iraqi government. The U.S. has been quite effective behind the scenes in pressuring Iraqis to get rid of Nouri al-Maliki, a divisive leader the U.S. backed far too long, but the U.S. did help ease him out to get other new leadership. Hopefully next week there'll be formation of a new government in Iraq, including a new defense minister, an understanding about a more decentralized Iraqi military that will include, in addition to Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, Sunni National Guard, Sunni units, Shia brigades. So the idea that people will defend the areas that they work in, which is the way to begin to get ISIS, the Islamic State, out. Similar policies are ahead for Syria. There's been a lot of talk quietly about how to do this, do that. That the U.S. already has a covert CIA program to train Syrian opposition fighters. I reported in the Washington Post this morning that there are now about 4,000, 4,000 to 5,000 fighters who've been trained by the U.S. I think the final thing I'd say is that there is an understanding after the disaster in Iraq that followed toppling a regime, creating a vacuum and seeing that vacuum filled with chaos and violence, to be careful that as the U.S. seeks to degrade and destroy ISIS, it makes sure that it has forces, Syrian opposition forces, Iraqi militias, and other government forces to come in and fill the vacuum. I think that lesson at least has been learned.
Boy, that sounds like a tall order to be certain of, to be sure that they have such – I mean, they haven't found them in a long time. Molly, what's the appetite in Washington as Congress comes back – just back for a couple of weeks here before they'll be off again. If the president's going to ask them for something in terms of sign off, a green light, what's Congress prepared to sign off on, Molly?
I don't think that's clear at this point. Again, you have a lot of demands on the White House, a lot of tough talk from members of Congress. And heaven forbid we should see politicians posturing, but that may be an element of what's going on. And members of Congress feeling like they ought to be consulted for this authorization. But it will be interesting to see if we see a replay of the sort of last Syria debate, which ended sort of inconclusively, where Obama said he was going to go to Congress and then ended up not because of in part of the Russia deal. But that was a situation. Situation where it seemed to go bad on the president very quickly once he announced he was going to involve Congress. Congress reacted very strongly to the force of public opinion, saying we don't want to go in any sort of forceful manner. And so, the members of Congress are very aware of that sentiment that Jack was talking about, that sentiment of war weariness and of not wanting to repeat the mistakes in Iraq. And I think in the details of what the White House is talking about and the things that David is talking about, you hear the ghosts of Iraq over and over again in the desire not to have a power vacuum, in the desire to work with the international community and to show a united front and to be cautious and sensible and not to be reckless. So I think that's going to be the approach, even if it means that Obama is accused of being weak or dithering.
Joe Biden says we're going to the gates of hell. What the appetite is for that, let's see. Howard in Black Lake, New York. Howard, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I believe that we should leave ISIS alone other than protecting the Kurds in the north. ISIS reestablishes the balance that we upset by taking out Saddam Hussein. ISIS gives the Sunnis a safe place. They shouldn't trust the Shiites in Iraq. And our alternative is about which fascists we're going to support, either ISIS, they're no great choice, or Iran, or Saddam, or Assad in Syria. They're all fascists. We shouldn't be supporting any one of them. We should be protecting the Kurds. And ISIS also gives us the advantage of preoccupying Iran so that they don't have the freedom that they've had after Saddam Hussein was taken out to make a mess of the region.
Howard, we've got it. I appreciate your call. David Ignatius, what about Howard's strategy here? Leave ISIS alone. Is that viable for the U.S.? We've seen two Americans beheaded. We've seen threats against the United States not to get involved. I mean, the ISIS-specific agenda is kind of take over the Islamic world with their caliphate. Is that okay?
The Obama administration has clearly decided that it's not okay. There was discussion over the last 6 weeks of precisely the point that Howard is making. Should we seek to contain this threat? Should we, in effect, deter ISIS, say, if you don't attack us, we won't necessarily attack you. We will work with others who oppose you, but you are not threatening the United States directly. I think that's now changed. Secretary of State Kerry said specifically today or yesterday that the U.S. policy toward ISIS is not containment. The president's word should be taken seriously, degrade and ultimately destroy.
Is that being driven strategically, David, or politically because they don't want to look –
no,
reckless.
I think politically people understand very well the kinds of things that Jack and Molly and Howard are saying. This is a war-weary country and, you know, fool me once, but shame on me if you fool me twice about Iraq. So, there's no appetite for doing it. I think the administration is trying to figure out a way to work with partners so that they're in the lead, that they're not just, as one official said to me, they're not going to hold our coat while we go off and do the fighting. And if they're prepared to stand up against this menace, and I must say I've seen stronger statements from Saudi Arabia, for example, on the ISIS threat than I've seen in some years. If they're ready to stand up and be serious about reordering their part of the world, then they ought to be helped by the United States big time, I think. But the key, as the president keeps stressing, is they need to take the first steps.
But how does reordering was the idea of going into Iraq. What's the evidence that the U.S. knows how to reorder this part of the world properly and then has the power to do it?
We don't. We don't. A, we don't know enough, and B, we don't have the power to do it, and that's been demonstrated. But this part of the world, which I've been visiting for too long, is in the process of a great transformation in which citizens are asserting themselves. Weirdly, ISIS is a part of that. And, you know, over time, I think it's going to lead to something, to greater stability. People will want different kinds of societies. And the president keeps talking about wanting a comprehensive strategy that will guide that transition. How it's done so that the U.S. is not directly exposed to big risks and loss of life, that's the puzzle of figuring out good policy.
Jack, to me, this looks like quite a straddle for this president to both maintain that no more Iraq's posture and to be part of a coalition that's setting out to destroy the Islamic State, to destroy ISIS. How do you do both?
With difficulty. And how do you fight ISIS? You know, ISIS has cards to play. David sketched the, you know, ideal scenario, or the scenario the administration is trying to encourage, of reconciliation in Iraq. Well, ISIS can play a card against that, and that is to polarize the groups even further. I mean, the spectacle this week of survivors, widows, and parents of soldiers who were massacred at one of these, with an ISIS takeover.
Crete, I think.
Yes,
They essentially took over the Iraqi parliament in their fury that their sons were hung out to die.
Yes, and it came out clearly that their sons were Shiites and that the Sunni officers, if that was one charge, didn't care about them. Well, you know, how many of, and then there were the shocks of these, you know, bombings of mosques. And how long before, you know, you have something like a revival of the really horrifying civil war of 2006, 2007? I mean, that's a card that ISIS can play sort of behind the lines, and I'm afraid they've got a fertile field to work on. You know, some scholars were canvassed this week by the New Republic asking, well, what, you know, scholars of Islam, what should we do to fight this caliph? And they seem to agree, or at least several did, you've got to kill this al-Baghdadi very quickly. Because the longer he's there, the longer he, you know, the more he draws in the alienated, the haters, the psychopaths, those who are mobilizable under this preposterous 8th century claim that he's the new caliph. And of course, yes, he would have a successor. But according to the clerics who follow this kind of thinking, there are only a limited number of these caliphs before the end of the world. And he's about number 8. So if he has a successor and his successor has a, the point is, this kind of thinking takes us deep into Syria if we are, in fact, going to try to kill him.
Well, I don't know. You take one person and there's such a thing as martyrdom. It has its own power as the Shia. Molly, let's bring it home, if we may, with the images all over TV last night of fast food workers all over this country. Not on strike exactly, but walking out, protesting in the streets, tying up traffic, getting arrested in large numbers. What's going on here, Molly?
Well, this seems to be the latest chapter in this ongoing debate that we've been having about inequality in America and about the minimum wage in America and about labor. You know, some labor unions are saying that they predict a resurgence as these movements spread because it is, in essence, a labor movement. It is about fairness to workers. And some unions are actually seeing some growth in their numbers as this sort of catches on. You know, this conversation about inequality has been happening for a long time, certainly since the Occupy protests, a lot of people point to that and see and say even though those protests fizzled out, the conversation never died. You have a rising strain of progressivism on the left, of sort of economic populism that's voiced by more and more candidates really on both sides of the aisle, Democratic candidates, but also Republicans railing against the fat cats and the establishment and wanting to – saying that they want to do more for the disadvantaged. And so these – I think all of these things are an expression of that.
Something stirring here. Cities all over the country saw these protests yesterday. Lots and lots of arrests. Here's one fast food worker talking with ABC 7 Eyewitness News in Chicago.
We're doing this for my grandkids and my great-great-great-grandkids. It's hard to make a living out here on $8.25 an hour. We're going to get arrested every day if need be.
David Ignatius, I do not remember when I last saw a demonstration like this of worker unhappiness that was so national, so explicit, and, you know, so in the camera's eye with the big signs, $15 an hour.
Well, you know, this is one of the aspects of instant communication, hashtag fast food workers protest wages.
Yeah.
It is possible to spontaneously pull together people around the country. I think the point that Molly made, that inequality is on the national agenda, the debate is going to take different forms. This is the latest. But there is an issue here. President Obama keeps coming back to it in his speeches. We need to rebuild a middle-class economy with good jobs, with reasonable wages. And yet he's been so weak politically, he hasn't been able to get much traction. But the issue is out there. And as Molly said, people are angry about it. On questions like wages for workers in fast food restaurants, the question always is whether significant increases in the wages end up reducing the willingness of people to hire entry-level workers who then get promoted to better wages. I just can't get into the details of this because I don't know it. But I think the basic point is the one Molly made. This issue is moving more and more to the center of the American debate.
Jack, I mean, the people in the street were very clear with their message that, look, you just cannot live on this minimum wage, which in many places is seven and change. Hasn't changed in 5 years. That's a long time to stay at that level. David says spontaneous, and I'm sure some of it is, but it is also not all spontaneous, Jack. There's clearly coordination here.
There is definitely coordination with SEIU, for example, mm-hmm. and with other groups, and that's significant. You know, this clearly adumbrates the politics of the future. This is what, or at least on the progressive side, Hillary Clinton is going to have to speak to this. The Republicans are going to have to speak to this. And, you know, polls show even a majority of Republicans favor an increase in the minimum wage. You have Walmart saying, well, maybe we need to think about raising wages. You have Alan Greenspan, the disciple of Ayn Rand, saying inequality is the main, our main sort of economic problem. You've got this sort of, strange coalition here of people saying this is a huge problem, and now you have this movement. Now, we don't know where the movement is. Is it at the Montgomery bus boycott? Is it the Woolworths demonstrators in 1960-61? Or are we later on the spectrum of protest? We don't know, but it's clear that this is a movement with the future in its bones because the problem is so clear.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, after new DNA evidence, a judge overturned 1983 rape and murder convictions that sent North Carolina's Henry McCollum and his half-brother Leon Brown to prison for more than 30 years. Henry spoke with reporters after being released.
I knew one day that I was going to be blessed to get out of prison. I just didn't know when that time was going to be.
That was a terrible long time to be in. What, against the evidence, it turns out. A great white shark attacked two kayakers off the coast of Plymouth, Massachusetts this week. A shaken Ida Parker told 7 News how the shark bit into one kayak and toppled them both.
I saw at least 4 feet of its head. 4 feet of it came up out of the water.
And nude photos of celebrities leaked by hackers taken from the cloud. Entertainment Tonight reported on the scandal.
We know Jennifer Lawrence and Kate Upton were victimized, but singer Ariana Grande is denying it, tweeting, "But for real, though, whoever thought those were actually me? Love you, but I'm praying for you."
How do you see this week's news on fast food workers and their pay, on the breach of security, the photos that went up to the cloud, and now all over the place, nude photos of celebrities and more, about Joan Rivers and the Ebola mess in Africa, with David Ignatius of The Washington Post, Molly Ball of The Atlantic, Jack Beattie is here. Akron, Ohio, Cy is calling. Cy, thanks, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
When Richard Nixon was running for president, Ray Kroc, the CEO of McDonald's, gave him $1 million. In return, Nixon exempted fast food restaurants from minimum wage legislation, and it was later on overridden by Congress, but the corporation, like Walmart, has a history of union busting and hope that people will take action about that.
I mean, there's action being taken, Cy. Do you think it's going to change the pay for fast food workers and others in this country?
Perhaps not immediately, but McDonald's has had a number of problems in the last year, and some hedge funds are advising a sale of their stock because a growing number of Americans are avoiding mammal flesh, and the company has caused billions of animals agony and human disease and global heating and environmental littering.
So you've got a long list, and we hear it. Labor and wages at the center of the news this week. I appreciate your call. Marietta, Georgia. Kyle, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm just calling because I want to talk. Like, I don't believe that people who flip burgers should make more than I do. And I went to college. I'm an EMT and stuff. And I don't think that they should make $15 an hour for something that anyone can do.
How much are you making these days, Kyle, may I ask?
I'm only making about $12 an hour.
So,
and I have a lot of certifications behind me.
Yeah.
That makes me a lot more desirable. But
so you put in the work for the diploma and burger flipping. When they say 15, you're like, hey, wait a minute. Molly Ball, the politics get interesting here. On the one hand, lots of people are feeling that the fact that wages have been stagnant for a long time. On the other hand, there's, you know, the pressure of the guy who says, wait a minute, I'm an EMT and the burger flipper is going to make more than me.
Absolutely. I mean, one point to make would be that if you had a $15 minimum wage, obviously nobody would make less than that. So the caller would not be making less than the fast food worker. And the argument the proponents of raising the minimum wage make is that it would sort of lift all boats, right? That once you raise the minimum, jobs that are now calibrated above the minimum, because it does set a floor, would then rise above that. An EMT, hopefully, is always going to make more than a burger flipper. And so if the burger flipper is making 15, the EMT starts making 20 or whatever it is. And then the counterpoint to that, as David mentioned, is the potential job killing effect. And economists love to argue over this. There is really no consensus about it, but there is a lot of political consensus about it. As you mentioned, there are large majorities of people. And I would also point out that there already has been an effect, not on the national level where Congress is hopelessly gridlocked, but a lot of states, New York, New Jersey, others have already raised their minimum wages in recent years. Cities like Seattle and San Francisco, and minimum wage ballot initiatives are going to be up this fall in Arkansas and I believe some other states. And so there are states and localities acting on this, even in the absence of congressional action.
Jack, I would think there would be more wind in the sails of the raise the minimum wage movement if the jobs numbers were better. Today's jobs numbers, not really good at all. Only 142,000 jobs added last month. People were expecting 200,000, 220,000. Unemployment rate down a little, but of course, there's always that participation rate problem. Who's actually in there? It may be a headwind here, Jack, if we don't have an economy that's just creating more jobs in the first place.
Well, that is certainly true. And, you know, we certainly don't see anything like a sustained momentum of recovery. I mean, this is the worst, I think, job report since the winter. You know, Larry Summers says secular stagnation, that's the situation we're in, and that you just are not going to get a self-sustaining economic recovery, absent the kind of massive infrastructure spending that nobody thinks is on the cards. So yes, it makes it tougher for people down below. On the other hand, the legal climate may be changing in their direction, the sort of going around public opinion, and that is this ruling of, what, a few months ago from the general counsel of the NRLB that McDonald's could be held jointly liable, that is, the corporation, for the activities of its franchises around the country, you know, violations of worker standards and so on. If that happens, you've got a huge wedge there for organized labor. They don't have to go from franchise to franchise. They can do it collectively.
One more call on the fast food front. Joe in Marfa, Texas. Joe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say that from a scientific point of view, in the computer chip, you could produce the food in a fast food place right now without a human being.
You're going to put robots in there to flip the burgers?
I'm going to put them in there. The advance from the wheel to the airplane has always brought about people getting less wages. The fact is that computer chip design, which you should have people on from not social scientists, is going to increase infinitesimally.
But what do we do then, Joe? Because, I mean,
I got an answer for you.
$7.25 an hour is hard, and it hasn't risen in 5 years.
I agree with you. But it's that the only answer is to make a Silicon Valley out of the United States instead of one state. And educationally, that means that even if it has to be pass-fail, instead of graded, every student should be taking a little physics, a little chemistry, because unless we make ourselves as good at or better than the people who, I mean, we got 6.9 billion people, and right now they all want the computer chip, and we're not competing with ourselves.
Well, we obviously are in corners, as you say. You say make it the whole country, take it to that plane. It's a high bar, but the options are rough here. We've got to get somewhere. I appreciate your call, Joe. Very tall order here, tall challenge. I want to look at Ferguson, Missouri for a moment. Attorney General Eric Holder there yesterday saying that the U.S. Justice Department is going to do a thorough investigation in the aftermath of all that we've seen of the Ferguson Police Department.
In Ferguson, our investigation will assess the police department's use of force, including deadly force. It will analyze stops, searches, and arrests, and it will examine the treatment of individuals detained at Ferguson's city jail, in addition to other potentially discriminatory policing techniques and tactics that have been brought to light.
Molly Ball, what could emerge? What could come out of this Justice Department investigation of the Ferguson Police Department?
Well, obviously, Eric Holder is saying that they have seen evidence believe it's worth investigating this discrimination, not only in Ferguson, but they're taking a broader look at other police departments in St. Louis as well. And, you know, this is a part of, I think, a trend that we have seen of Eric Holder really being the Obama administration's voice on racial issues, in part because it's his job as attorney general to investigate discrimination, but in part because it's clearly his passion and it's something where he feels he has a duty and a license to speak where Obama has often been hesitant. You know, the president was criticized for the tepid nature of his remarks on Ferguson, whereas Eric Holder has given a number of speeches where he has talked about race in very strong and forthright terms.
But let's say they find a pattern of discrimination. What happens? Are there charges here of some kind from the attorney general?
I think there absolutely could be. That's what the Department of Justice does. If there is a pattern of discrimination, they have the ability to prosecute, to bring a lawsuit. So that's, you know, potentially far in the future. But he's clearly signaling that they're going to take a thorough look at this.
Molly, can you take us a little further west to Kansas and this incredible story this week of the Democratic candidate for the U.S. Senate there challenging Republican Senator Pat Roberts, dropping out or trying to drop out of the race, an independent in Kansas, sort of Democratic-leaning, I guess you tell us, who looked like he might have a pretty good chance of knocking Roberts out if the Democrat Chad Taylor dropped out. Now, what the law says, the Kansas Secretary of State says the Democrat cannot drop out. Where does that leave this race?
It leaves it very up in the air. I love this story just because it's so unexpected. Nobody expected Kansas to come onto the Senate map, except in the primary, where Pat Roberts had a very strong challenge from a Tea Party candidate that really exposed his weaknesses as a candidate, even as a longtime incumbent. You know, the Tea Party challenger got within, single digits of Roberts, which is not something you expect for a longtime incumbent. And a lot of that residual antagonism for him seems to have carried over. He hasn't run a particularly adroit campaign. He has seemed often sort of out of touch with the state, having to scramble to backtrack on statements he's made about not really living in Kansas. And now you have this businessman, Greg Orman, who says he has been a Democrat and a Republican. He has given to Democrats and run as a Democrat in the past, but he describes himself as a centrist. And so the Democratic candidate seems to have made the calculation that if he dropped out, that anti-Roberts vote could be consolidated. And indeed, in a recent poll, if you add together the Chad Taylor, the Democrats' voters, and Greg Orman's voters, you get to 52%. So
has Orman said he would caucus with Democrats in the Senate?
He has not said. No, what he's saying is sort of like Angus King in Maine, who did end up caucusing with the Democrats. But before he was elected, he said, you know, I'm a wild card. I have sympathies with both parties, and my state will have more clout because I can sort of play them off one another or be a power broker. Now, as you mentioned, the Secretary of State, the Republican Secretary of State in Kansas, did not allow the Democratic candidate to drop out, said there was a technical problem.
The name will stay on the ballot.
The letter
anyway.
He submitted, mm-hmm. and his name will stay on the ballot. There may be a challenge to that decision. It'll be interesting to see whether he can drop out without dropping out, right? If he mm-hmm. it sends a strong enough signal to voters that he says he doesn't want to be in the race.
David Ignatius, let's bring it home to your backyard in state politics in Virginia, where we've got Governor Bob McDonnell and his wife both convicted this week on big counts, 11 corruption charges against McDonnell, 9 against his wife. They could be facing a lot of jail time. We heard a lot of crying in the courtroom. What has just gone down here, David?
Well, this trial has been spectacle that the people living in this area have been watching with fascination, sometimes horror, for the last few weeks and months. What was strange about this case was the defense put on by the McDonald's that their marriage had failed, that they didn't talk to each other. Almost seemed to me to be worse than conviction. They were portrayed by their own attorneys as people who kind of had lost touch in the time that McDonald was governor. The message, I think, for the country is that politicians are going to have to be more careful about the relationships they have with business people, the gifts they accept from business people. I mean, in this case, the jury found that these gifts were directly linked to McDonald's performance in office. It was a pretty high bar that the jury set in its finding. It's possible that the sentencing instructions the judge gave will be challenged. But politicians around the country are going to have to think a lot more carefully about accepting that freebie that some local businessman offers them.
David, very quickly on the celebrity hacking front, what's the lesson here? Is it that nothing is secure in the cloud? Or is everybody rethinking what they're shipping up their hand over fist these days, or not? After all these nude photos were released,
there may be people, you know, panicking and trying to get things out of the cloud. But I think the real lesson is the one you suggest, that privacy, as we traditionally imagined it, basically is gone. Someday there may be more secure architectures. There may be ways to really protect information. But now it really looks as if the advantage is with the hackers. I just wrote a novel this year that you mentioned, the director, which is all about the pervasiveness of hacking, almost the sport of it. People hack these things because they can. And it's very hard to say that information, whether it's your credit information at Home Depot or photographs you may have taken or somebody may have taken of you that are being held in cloud storage, that they're really safe and protected, not to mention issues about what the NSA might be looking at.
We've got to hear one more time from comedian Joan Rivers, died at 81 this week. She was with us in 2009, talked about how she began doing comedy in clubs, how she struggled during her first decade as a female comedian.
I think a lot of it was I was a woman and I was a nice looking woman. In those days, we're talking now the 60s, you had to like the pretty one was a singer, the ugly one was the comic. And I was single. I would come out trying to look nice in my little black dress and my circle pin and talk. And it was a big revolution in comedy. And they just didn't want to accept a woman that would say, I mean, I talked about having an affair with a married professor. People would faint in nightclubs.
Jack Beatty, she talked about having an affair with a married professor. That was very tame talk by the time Joan Rivers' career ran its course. This was a woman who would go after anything, say anything. She said what was on her mind, even when it was not at all sweet or popular.
Yes, a documentary, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, shows a scene in Wisconsin where she was making a joke about Helen Keller, and a man protests. He says, I have a deaf son. And she shot back, I happen to have a deaf mother. And then she said, oh, you stupid ass, let me tell you what comedy is about. Comedy is to make everybody laugh at everything and deal with things, you idiot. Deal with things. Comedy as coping.
Joan Rivers, no backing down, all the way, and I mean all the way. With us just last month when Robin Williams died, and now gone herself at 81. Rest in peace, Joan Rivers. Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being with us today. We see you're on Twitter now, at Jack Beatty NPR, the very modern man, Jack. Good luck with all that.
Thank you very much.
David Ignatius at the Washington Post, yes, author of The Director, a novel out this summer. David, thanks for your insights today.
Thanks, Tom.
And Molly Ball, national political writer at The Atlantic. Thanks so much for joining us, Molly.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.